reaches forth to say, let me talk to you about rebuilding these broken. Let me tell you how to do this. And it's going to work. It's going to be successful. And Nehemiah is the place to go. And so we're looking at, okay, God, show us. God, tell us. So we're going to be talking about Nehemiah chapter 2. So if you'd like to open your Bibles there in just a minute, we'll begin reading kind of where we left off last night in verse 17. We'll talk about Nehemiah chapter 2. But while you're turning there, let me just reference a New Testament passage. You may want to look at it later, but it's in Ephesians chapter 3, and it's in verse number 20. And there it is a general promise or kind of a picture of what God can do in comparison to the wildest dreams that our prayers might dare offer to God. I mean, this, on your boldest day, on your most faithful and confident day, you kneel down and you talk to God and you ask Him for remarkable things that surprise you that they come out of your mouth. Okay, imagine that. And then read Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 and know that God can do beyond that. But that's not really what that passage says. God can do exceeding and abundantly beyond all that we ask or imagine. That's what God can do. So, with faith in that kind of God, we seek His guidance, we listen to His teaching, and we follow Him and pray that in our lives and every other relationship, may the health of those relationships not be limited to our vision and to our dreams. But God, please take us to those places that you see possible. So, I mean, what would God's dream for this church be? What would he like to see? I mean, I've heard some prayers from Christians here. I can imagine the kind of prayers that are offered by faithful brothers who talk to God about such important things. Good. Good. And keep praying them, and keep praying bigger prayers. But now, in light of Ephesians 3, verse 20, where would God like you to go? What would He like for you to see? What would He like for you to try? What kind of fears or apprehensions or limitations have you been operating under that He'd like to see you blast out of the way and go somewhere else? I wonder what that would look like. And we must step in that direction, because that's the God that we serve. And so we'll talk some more as we continue our studies in these few days together. We'll talk some more about prayer. In fact, that's the last lesson on Monday night. And really looking forward to talking about that. But our job this afternoon here from this first lesson is to talk about this. We've already introduced what's going on in the book of Nehemiah. After 70 years of captivity in Babylon, the captives start coming back to Jerusalem. Nehemiah is still in captivity, now under Persian rule. And he gets word that Jerusalem, it's still desolate. I mean, people have come back. In fact, 141 years have passed since the city's destroyed, and captives have come back. But they haven't done anything to fix the walls around Jerusalem. I mean, it could easily be overthrown all over again, and when Nehemiah hears that, his heart is broken. And he weeps, and he fasts, and he prays, and he does that for about 4 months, and what he prays about is found in chapter 1, and as he brings his cup of wine to the king, which is his job in his slavehood, he brings the cup to the king, and the king inquires, "What's going on with you, Nehemiah? You've got some problem of heart." And Nehemiah opens his heart and says what the problem is. "I'm worried for my own people. How can I help you? What do you want?" says the king. And in verse 4 of Nehemiah chapter 2, before Nehemiah answered that question, he prayed. We're going to have a lot more to say about that Monday night. Okay. Wow. I have done that. Maybe you have too. You're at a real important crossroads. What you say next matters. And you pray. Nehemiah did that. And what happened was the king gave him permission to go back, gave him letters to get all the materials he needed to rebuild. He goes back to Jerusalem. He surveys the wall. He announces the brokenness to the people. And it says, it's time for us to arise and build. And if we skip ahead to chapter 6, verse 15, they got it rebuilt in 52 days. So our task now and for the next few minutes is to say, who did this? I mean, it's a remarkable undertaking. And God, with all of his power, did not exercise his power by just miraculously causing the walls to be rebuilt. That is not what God did. There were people involved. Okay, wow. Then I'd like to know who these people were that could do things that had generationally been judged impossible. Or nobody had tried it before. Nobody thought they had enough money. Nobody thought they had enough know-how. Maybe they were afraid. I don't know. But nobody had tried it. What kind of people will try what's not been tried before? What kind of people can rebuild a wall that's been broken down for 141 years and rebuild it in 52 days? I'd like to know something about those guys. Because if we could tap in to what's going on inside these people, we could find out what makes them tick. And we're looking at things that please God, and then duplicate that. And we could be the kind of people that can accomplish remarkable things in our generation to the glory of God. Now we're thinking the right way. Now God, I wonder what God can do with that, with a group of people who are thinking like that. I don't know what he can do, but I can tell you what he has done. And it's off the charts. So let's find out about these people, as remarkable as they are. Who are these people? Okay, I said we were going to read in Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse number 17. And last night we talked about this verse, and we made the observation as we looked at it that after Nehemiah had surveyed the walls around the city, he came back. They were broken down. It was a mess. He came back, and he reported to them. And then you see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we will no longer be a reproach. Okay, so we talked about leadership last night and calling the team together. Leadership calls people who have a stake in the issue, calls them to get off the sidelines, get off the bench, and get in the game. Come on, let us arise and build. Okay. But we didn't read last night verse 18. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words, which he had spoken to me. Let me stop there for a second. And so he's talking about the events that were described earlier in chapter 1 and in chapter 2. And the good hand of God was upon Nehemiah. He knew it. It wasn't about Nehemiah. It was all about God. And when it came time to tell the people, that's exactly what he said. So we're in the middle of verse 18, and he talked to them about how the hand of God had been favorable to me in the king's word which he had spoken. Verse 18 ends this way. Then they said, this is the people, this is the response of the people to Nehemiah. First time we hear from them. Then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. So a leader speaks up, tells them about God's involvement, God's calling. This is the hand of God at work, and you've got to be involved in this. And they listen, and they said, he is right. Come on, we're in. And so they said, let us arise and build. So let me just identify the first thing that I noticed about who these people are that do these remarkable things. And first thing to notice about them is that they were responsible people. Well, when I thought about that, I'm pretty sure I don't really understand, like I'd like to, what it means to be responsible. And I can use the word, and I can talk about they are responsible people, and I know that's a good thing, and I have a general idea. What exactly does it mean to be a responsible person? I mean, are you a responsible person? Are you? Am I? A responsible person would be so disappointed that I'm making such a big deal out of this. Is a person who responds. They don't listen. They don't make excuses. They don't wait for somebody else to do it. They don't give their money to some institution to take care of their job for them. Responsible people respond. Responsible people say, in verse 18, let us arise and do it. I see the picture. You're calling me. Guess what? I'm with you. I'm not going to pass it off. I'm not going to make excuses. You're not going to hear me say I don't have enough money. You're not going to hear me say I don't have enough education. You're not going to hear me say I'm too old or I'm too young. You're not going to hear any of that. I'm going to respond. I'm going to get up, and I've got a job to do. I see it, and that's what I'm going to do. Now, let me ask you, in light of that, are you a responsible person? When it is very clear to you, it's time to get off the bench, roll up your sleeves, and get in the work. What do you do next? I got a busy life. After I graduate, after I get my career, after I get married, after we have children, when the children are raised, I mean, there's always excuses. I don't know. What do you say? The remarkable thing about these people is that the kind of people God did remarkable things with were people who responded. And in light of all the excuses that you have heard, and I am very familiar with too. It is so remarkable. Now, we don't read anything about that here. They just get up and go. So, success comes to people like this. And the first thing that I want us to notice is they were responsible. Now, before I leave this point, I'm going to tell you, Jeremy and Brittany Eldridge, the folks from Indiana, may know those two people. They were briefly members of the church at Newcastle right after they got married. And when they came to Newcastle as a newly married couple, they talked to the elders of the church and they said, we want to be used in whatever way y'all want to use us. And we have already decided that whatever you ask of us, our answer is going to be yes. Whatever you ask, whatever you need, our answer is yes. There are two responsible people. They are ready to respond. They didn't come to Newcastle to be coddled or let somebody do something for them. They didn't come making excuses. We're too young. We just got married. We're trying to establish our careers. None of that. We came to Newcastle to work. Our answer is yes. Now, verse 17 and 18 kind of draw a conclusion to what the response of the people is. There are two other verses in chapter 2. And let's go ahead and read them because they introduce us to the bad guys. Well, actually, the bad guys of the story have been talked about in verse 10. But verse 19 says, but when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, what is this thing you are doing, Are you rebuilding, or excuse me, are you rebelling against the king? So I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. So be ready as you read the book of Nehemiah. You're going to see rebuilders at work. What kind of people are they? They're going to be people who are going to do the right thing when doing the right thing is hard. Because there's going to be bad guys. And I don't know your all situations, and you don't know mine. But when you set your mind in some way to shake off the past, and get off the sidelines, and mean it as a follower of Jesus, I'll guarantee you something. You're going to have opposition. It's not going to be easy. No matter how excited you might be, no matter how many other people are in it with you, doesn't matter, you're going to face opposition. It's going to come. And so this work, these people who are successful rebuilders are so, not because their work is easy, but they are successful even when their work is hard. So look over in chapter 4, and let's explore the second thing that I want you to notice about who these people were. And by the time we get to chapter 4, they're at the work of rebuilding. But let's see, if you'll notice in verse 6 of chapter 4, that where we are in the story of their rebuilding is halfway. We'll have more to say about the importance of that in just a moment. But in verse 14 of chapter 4, now that when the enemy had come against them, now they were not just making fun of them or mocking them or just angry at them. Now the opposition had escalated because the walls were going up. And so as success among God's people increased, so did the intensity of the opposition. Now they were ready to kill them. Geshem, Tobiah, the Arabs were ready to kill. They made a plot, and the Jews who were rebuilding found out about that plot. So listen to what happened in verse 14. When I saw their fear, Nehemiah said of the people he was working with, when I saw their fear, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. And then look at verse number 20 in the same chapter. So they were making preparation to continue the work. And verse 20 says, at whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. I know I didn't tell the whole story that's going on in chapter 4. And we'll talk about it more later in a separate lesson focused upon the story of verse 4, of chapter 4. That comes later. But I read these select verses to draw your attention to the fact that no matter how hard it got, no matter how discouraged they got, no matter how fearful they were, they remembered God. Sometimes they were helped in that by a leader that would say, I saw their fear, and I spoke to them, and I said, don't be afraid, remember the Lord. Somebody's got to remind us of that. Because sometimes we can lose our grip. These people remembered the Lord. And when they were afraid, and they were told again in verse number 20, our God will fight for us. So these rebuilders that proved to be the kind of men and women, boys and girls, who could be used by God successfully, they were, number two, they were faithful people. They were faithful people. They were responsible, and they were, number two, they were faithful. They trusted God. And so this, a little bit of the story of chapter 4 is they prayed, they trusted that God would take care of them. But you know what they did? They didn't say, oh, I have faith in God, so he's going to take care of my problems and sit down and wait and watch for God to do his thing. That is not what happened here. They prayed, they trusted God, and so they had a weapon in one hand and a building block in another. And they kept building, and they kept that sword or that weapon, they kept building. They were ready to fight. They were positioned in the wall to protect the city. They trusted God, and it was evident that they trusted God by their faithful response to the enemy. Look in the New Testament. You'll want to come back to Nehemiah in just a moment, but look at Mark chapter 4. This is has come to be one of my favorite stories in the Gospels, because I so often need to hear it. Mark chapter 4 and verse number 35 beginning. We'll read to the end of the chapter. And of course, this is a snapshot from the life of Jesus. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, let us go over to the other side. Leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in a boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much that the boat was already filling up. Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep. Okay. Jesus was asleep in the midst of a fierce gale. And he was asleep on a cushion, and they woke him up and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? But he got up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, hush, be still. And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, why are you afraid? How is it that you have no faith? Why is it that you have no faith? I mean, I'm on board. Everything's going to be all right. Let the wind blow. Let it rain. I'm on board. Where is your faith? They became very much afraid and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Okay, the helpful picture of this story is one that does increase our faith. And it reminds us that no matter what the storms or the difficulties and the challenges and the opposition that you might face in your life, if you have been redeemed by the blood of Jesus Christ, and if you are walking in the light as he is in the light, he's on board. Don't act like he's not. Because if he's on board and you're acting like he's not, the problem is your faith. And this is the passage that says so. And too often, I forget. Or I act like I have forgotten that he's on board. Shame on me. And this passage brings it right back. Okay, hang in there. Don't be knocked off balance. Don't get discouraged. He is on board. So the second thing we can conclude now is that these people we read about in Nehemiah that did such remarkable things did so because they were faithful people. Now go to Nehemiah chapter 3. And this is my favorite chapter in the book of Nehemiah. And I think I said something about that last night. I can't read it, or at least I can't read it out loud. I'm getting better at it because I listen to recorded readings of the Bible, and I listen to people who can say all these Bible names very well, and I'm getting the hang of it, but it's difficult. But it's my favorite chapter, and I want to tell you why it's my favorite chapter. And let me read, or try to read, the first 5 verses of Nehemiah chapter 3, and follow along in your Bible, if you will. And this comes, of course, right after Nehemiah called them to the task of working, and they said, let us rise and build. Then Eliashib, the high priest, arose with his brothers, the priests, and built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and hung its doors. They consecrated the wall to the Tower of the Hundred and the Tower of Hananel. Next to him, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zakur, the son of Imri, built. Now the sons of Hasaniah built the fish gate, They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah, the son of Hakaz, made repairs. And next to him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, the son of Baana, also made repairs. And verse 5 begins, moreover, next to him, and then the list goes on. And as you read through, or just look through, the rest of chapter 3, there are 42 groups of people who are named in this chapter. It's a list of who's working along the walls. And the picture is, here's a family, here are a group of people, here are some people from a nearby town who have showed up when it's time to work, and they're taking care of this section of the wall. And next to them, here are the people taking care of this section of the wall. And next to them, and next to them, and next to them. And Nehemiah chapter 3 is a list of the people who were involved in rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem. You know what's interesting about these people, aside from how hard it is to say their names? Most of these people we know nothing about. They're not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. We don't know who their parents are, who their children are. We don't know very much about them. That's not true of all of them, but that's true of most of these people. These are unknown people. And you know what? In the view of history, that's exactly the place that you're going to have. And that's exactly the place I'm going to have. In the eyes of this world, we are unknown people. But these unknown people were only unknown to the world because God, through His Holy Spirit, has preserved the names of these unknown people for all generations because they were not unknown to God. They were dear to God. God knew their names, or if you look down through there, verse 8, it says that Hanani, one of the perfumers, God knew not only what the man's name was, but He knew what kind of work he did. Verse 9 talks about a man who was an official of half the district of Jerusalem, and he was working. In verse 12, a man worked with his daughters along the wall. In verse number 20, there was a man who zealously repaired. There are people who were working on the wall who were doing their work, even though the people assigned to oversee them did not want them to succeed in their work. And yet they went right ahead and worked successfully anyway. You look at verse number 20, there were temple servants. Verse number 27, people from the village of Tekoa. Verse 28, there were priests who worked along the wall. Verse number 31, there were goldsmiths. And verse number 32, there were merchants. And we'll find later that Nehemiah himself took his place. I guess we did talk about that last night. Took his place along the wall. Nehemiah was there. What a remarkable group of people. They came from all walks of life. They were all ages. Children worked along on that wall. Many of them worked on the wall right outside where they lived. Now, can you picture this? They got up in the morning, they got ready, they walked out their door, stepped out onto the wall that needed to be repaired, and they started putting one block on top of another, or removing the rubble, whatever stage of the rebuilding was going on, they worked right outside their own home. Can you see the application? Can you see what God would like for you to do? They do it right in front of you. What do you see when you open your door in the morning? Maybe that is exactly the place where God would like you to shine. Show your faith without any regard for whether you're famous or ever will be remembered. That's not important at all. What you're doing is pleasing to God, and He knows your name. So, count me in. I'm going to do my part. I'm going to put one block on top of another. And you know, I don't think I talked about this last night. You know when they did this? You know what time of year they did this? They did this in the Savannah summer. And I have more appreciation for a Savannah summer now than I used to have. did their work in August, the hottest month of the year in the city of Jerusalem. And the temperatures then were about like they are in Savannah, Georgia. And that's the kind of weather that these people got out every day and rebuilt the wall while the enemy was plotting their destruction. And these people whose names the world will never remember, these unnamed heroes, just opened their door and they did the work in front of them. And they worked shoulder to shoulder with people who were just like them. And a wall that had been neglected for 141 years was rebuilt in 52 days. Now, I really do wonder what God could do with the Christians in this generation. What could he do with the people in the church that you're a part of, the local church that you're a part of, this congregation, or the one where I'm from? What would he do? What could he do with people who were thinking like this? And so in chapter 4, verse number 6, backing up just a moment, to this passage, to this verse that says, when in the rebuilding of the wall the story is told, verse 6 says, So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Okay, the last thing I want to say about these amazing people, they knew how to respond. They were responsible. They were faithful to God. They were unknown. They were not public heroes. But the last thing that stands out about them, is they had a mind to work. You ever tried to supervise somebody that didn't have a mind to work? Sarah's been a school teacher. I don't know. Oh, Kathy's a school teacher. You ever tried to teach somebody who didn't have a mind to be at school? The last place they wanted to be. Redford Shoemaker. Nobody in this room knows Redford Shoemaker. He played right field on my little league baseball team. Redford Shoemaker did not have a mind to play baseball. He sat down in right field and he picked flowers. And the rest of the team hoped the opposing team would not hit a ball to right field. Because Redford Shoemaker just didn't have a mind to play baseball. I don't know what happened to him. I'm sure he found his place. But he's not a professional baseball player. But on the other hand, have you ever noticed a student with a mind to work? Can you imagine somebody who wants to be a pianist and they have a mind to practice the piano? Or somebody who wants to be a basketball player and they have a mind to be a the thing you got to do is get out of their way. Because you're going to slow them down. You know, you can't stop somebody. You ever heard somebody say, if he makes up his mind about something, there's no changing it. Okay, now that's kind of used in a negative sort of way. But it does illustrate how powerful a thing it is when somebody makes up their mind about something. And according to verse number 6, the rebuilding of the wall was moving along at such a rapid pace because the people had a mind to work. You have to argue with people like that. You don't have to beg them or bribe them or threaten them because they have a mind to work. Now, how is it for you and me as citizens in the kingdom of God with the most noble of responsibilities in a world of darkness that needs to be saved? Can it be said of you and me? Can God see of us? Now there's a man, there's a woman with a mind to work. Get out of their way, don't slow them down, because they're going to run right over you if you try. You can't stop somebody that has a mind to work. I think the New Testament gives us a picture of some people like that. This wasn't the only time the world was blessed by people with a mind to work. The New Testament, following the story of Jesus and the establishment of the church in Acts chapter 2, And then the spread of the gospel so that within 30 years of the death of Jesus, the gospel had gone to all of the world by unknown people, many of whom were running for their lives because persecution had divided their families, had taken their jobs, and were threatening their life. And so they were running for their lives. And everywhere they went, you know what they did? Read Acts chapter 11 and find out. They went everywhere teaching the gospel. They spread the word everywhere they went. And the world was turned upside down. Now, there are always going to be obstacles and difficulties and challenges in Acts chapter 14 and verse number 22. In the midst of this remarkable story, tells us that only through many tribulations can we enter the kingdom of heaven. So people with a mind to work realize that there's going to be difficulties. But that reminder doesn't stop them. It only helps them prepare for what is ahead. These people did not seek to get out of work. They didn't work just when they were excited to be doing that work. They worked because they had a mind to do so. Okay, now I've got to stop here. Now I'm watching the clock, you see. And I want to end by telling you briefly a story that Kim and I stumbled upon a few years ago. We were able to visit up on the upper peninsula of Michigan along the shore of Lake Superior. And up there, there is a place called Whitefish Point, and a museum is there, a small maritime museum. And you walk in, and there is a song playing in the background. And when I walked in, I heard that song, and it took me back to my youth. I know that song. And the song was the Ballad of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Okay, some of you knew where I was going with this. So you may know the story. And the story is that the Edmund Fitzgerald was a freighter that carried iron, carried huge amounts of weight, record amounts of weight, all across the Great Lakes during the 1960s. And in November of 1975, the Edmund Fitzgerald was carrying a huge payload of iron ore going west to east across Lake Superior when one of the fiercest winter storms ever to hit Lake Superior came. And the Edmund Fitzgerald battled the storm for 2 days. And then on Wednesday, November the 10th, Captain McSorley on the radio at 7:10 in the evening spoke the last words to come from the Edmund Fitzgerald. And his last words were, "We are holding our own." Those were the last words. "We are holding our own." Nobody knows for sure what happened next. But the Edmund Fitzgerald sank 535 feet to the bottom of Lake Superior, taking with it the lives of 29 men, 17 miles from the Whitefish Point Lighthouse. So when I heard that story, nobody was preaching any sermon about it. But it sure did remind me that it is not enough to say we're holding our own. You're not out of danger when you say, "We're holding our own." No, you got to do better than that. We all have to do better than that. The waves are going to test. The waves are, they'll have its way. If the best we've got to offer is, I'm okay. Don't bother me. I'm holding my own. No, you got to turn face those waves, and you got to keep at it. Not hold our own. So, whatever the situation with your life, and of course with mine, and may God help us to be people who are like those we read about in Nehemiah, the kind of people that God can do remarkable things with. Turn the world upside down. do what none of us would ever think possible. But when our faith is in God and our mind is to work, we're not holding our own. But by the help and grace of God, He's pulling us forward to do the work in our generation that He's called upon us to do. I hope that will be true for all of us in our individual lives, and be true for this church and God's people everywhere. All right, thank you all for your attention. We'll break for a little bit and then come back again.